Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
A new book tells 13 stories of those who have experienced some of humanity's most inhumane acts, including survivors from Auschwitz, the killing fields of Cambodia and Rwanda. They've all managed to make their way to Oregon and make new lives for themselves. That's where journalist Elizabeth Marin spoke with them for the new book, I Live to Tell the World. She joins us now. Elizabeth, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Before we dive into a few of the stories in the book, I'd love to know why you wanted to tell us the stories of the survivors.
I thought it was really important to humanize some of these events of recent history and to do so by telling the stories through the people. Also, I thought that these were stories about survivors, not victims. These are people who are living with courage and with persistence, determination, and most of all, hope.
So the first story you tell is an older Jewish couple who survived the Holocaust, and there's so much that's terrifying in their recollections. But one thing that sticks with me is the detail that Eva Egner, then a teenager, and her sister, tell us what happened to Eva.
Eva and her sister had been in the Jewish ghetto in Budapest, unthinkable conditions. Their mother had been taken from them. They didn't know where she was. And in the final days of the war, of the Nazi occupation of Hungary, they were determined, the Nazis were determined to finish their job. So they were marching people from the ghetto to the banks of the Danube, where they were shot and their bodies hurled into the swirling, freezing waters below them. And the two sisters were in line when, literally, out of nowhere, their mother appeared. And she took the last remaining piece of item that she had of any value, which was her wedding ring, and she turned to the Nazi guard and said, "Please, you have children too. Please spare my girls. Take my wedding ring." And he did.
It's an incredible story. And like so many survivors, she didn't tell her children or her family all the details of what she survived. And understandably, they're really traumatic memories. I'm wondering, is that why people like Eva and her husband didn't talk a lot about what they lived through?
Well, I think it's more complicated than that. I think they came to this country with virtually no English. They had $25 to spend on a train ride from New Jersey to Portland, Oregon, which was not a lot if you have to buy food. They wanted to live their lives. They wanted to move forward. They became very productive citizens. Eva went to cosmetology school, worked her way through by scrubbing the bowls and painting the walls and cleaning the floors. Les went on and became a tool and die cutter, very skilled work. And they put their children through college. They bought a house. They had a life. And it wasn't until the Holocaust deniers showed up that they began discussing what had happened to them.
I want to move to your chapter on Pol Pot and what the Khmer Rouge did in Cambodia. I have to say, Elizabeth, that was like a really deep history lesson for me. So many people killed, so many displaced, the country completely destroyed. You tell the story of Sveng Ung and Van Tuch, who have a hellish escape story. We'll let people read their story in your book. But they manage to survive, and they go on to build a life in the US in Portland. And I'm wondering, you know, how did they even begin to build a life after all they had been through?
Sveng Ung went to ESL classes. She studied at night. She got jobs. It was a recurring theme that I heard from a lot of women, that they cleaned houses, and that the women for whom they cleaned houses gave them sort of ad hoc English lessons, among other things. And they settled into a life. They raised children. Sveng went on and became a counselor for other immigrants, among other things, and also started a flower arranging business.
Yeah. Now, as we're talking, it's the 30th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. And one of the most notable things about that was as it happened, as children and women and men were being slaughtered, the international community did nothing. And just like the world was too late to stop the slaughter of so many Jews by Nazi Germany, decades later, inaction as Tutsis are massacred. But this time, you know, there's technology, there's global news media, and the world knew what was happening, why was there no global intervention to stop that genocide?
It was a pretty complicated situation. There's a lot of evidence that there was knowledge in advance that this was going to happen. Mm. And even Bill Clinton himself has later said, well, maybe we could have done something. But, you know, Rwanda's gone on and they've done some really extraordinary things. You know, it's illegal to identify people by tribe in Rwanda now after what happened there. And there was counseling for citizens who wanted it. There was a big response within the country, even though we outside the country did not respond.
Yeah, lots of lessons to learn there from inside Rwanda. You also profile a musician from Bosnia, Diana Ihas. She plays the viola and was a member of the Sarajevo String Quartet in the early 1990s. The city was under siege for 4 years by Serbian forces, but the quartet continued to perform even as bombs were falling on the city. Can you tell us about how important it was for musicians to continue to play? I mean, you even have a story about how Diana went above and beyond to perform at a concert when she was about to give birth.
Yes, she gave birth 45 minutes after the end of the concert. Mm. This group of musicians, it's even more poignant than that. During the course of the siege, they lost two of their members, one killed by a sniper and another by a shrapnel. And they replaced them with other members. They felt that the music was saving the soul of the city. People came out in spite of the danger, in spite of the risk to public spots. There was no electricity. People didn't have windows by that time. There was no heat. They practiced in an unheated basement. They walked across the city from place to place because people didn't have cars or gasoline for cars to perform in bombed-out churches and temples and public spaces. And they wanted to bring music to the soul of their city.
Yeah, it was almost like a therapy. I want to end, Elizabeth, with one of the last chapters of your book, and this is Gaza. It appears to have been written before the Hamas attacks of October 7th. You bring us a young woman, Noor, who lived through a lot in Gaza and finally escaped. Can you tell us briefly what she experienced?
She attended a school run by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency that was bombed, possibly by accident, while she was still even in elementary school. And she talks about her childhood racked by violence. But she stresses repeatedly, I'm a Palestinian and I do not have to represent a political party. I represent my truth and what I have lived through. So the story is about her attempt to study in the United States and how long it took her to get out. She had a very harrowing journey to get to the United States. Her dream was to bring banking and microfinancing to the women, in particular, of Palestine, because it wasn't part of their culture as much. Mm. After she got here, she encountered bias. People at her workplace, a bank, who wanted to challenge her based on her nationality and ethnicity. What she said was, my identity here is always spurring uninvited conversations. Mm. And as we know from many people in this book, that's not uncommon.
Given what's happening, you know, in Gaza, as the world is watching yet again and thousands of people are being killed, have you been in touch with Noor? I imagine this is a very hard time for her.
Yes, we've been in touch with her, and it's very hard for her to talk about any of this because it's so traumatic and upsetting. It's, as you say, it's playing out in real time. This is her country.
Elizabeth, you end the book with some lessons you've learned from the stories of the people you talk to. I wonder if you can just leave us with one.
Mm. Well, it's hard for me to limit it to one. I guess one is persistence and hope, keeping hope in dark moments. Also, I think sometimes the ability to laugh at what seems like a hopelessly absurd situation helps you to get through it. And I saw that over and over among these survivors, where they could, here were these just horrific moments, and they could summon a laugh and get them through it.
Elizabeth Marin's book is I Live to Tell the World, Stories from Survivors of Holocaust, Genocide, and the Atrocities of War. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you, Deepa.
And as we said, this coming weekend marks 30 years since the genocide in Rwanda. We'll be spending time over the next month marking this horrific mass killing. Later this week, we'll speak with survivor Emmanuel Tuyotoranye, who's profiled in Elizabeth's book.